Okay, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
Now funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the is so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's wrong.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
Now's my shit together, is my shit together.
Nice personality combination, hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Well, no base stacks and jacks. I've come out with Carter on the board. SP futures unchanged. NASDAQ futures up 35. Yes, NASDAQ futures have to be up. Do we have Professor Carl?
Oh, you do.
What's up, bud? Hope you're along your cues.
Well, you know, let me point out something. If you're wondering why it's all fake and gay and everything is insane, and all of it starting and emanating from D.C., may I ask, did you grill hamburgers for Father's Day?
Funny you should mention that. There I was a week ago at the Myers, and they had a special on entire beef briskets. My brother.
We get those around here two or three times a year, and I'll tell you, yeah, you give me one of them, and it's going in the smoker at about 11 o'clock the night before.
Yep. Well, my brother cooks on Sundays. He's kind of a central spot, and his whole gang comes over, and the two little girls everybody wants to see, and so forth. So I said, "Hey, you want this brisket?" He goes, "Yeah." And so I bite a thing. I think it was 23 pounds or something. It's a biggie. It's the smallest one in the box or in the thing. But he put it on way in the morning, long before he went to play softball. But you know, we have a talk about something weird. They still sell them. You ever seen a Nesco roaster? They're, you know, their electric roasters, a big roaster. There's about three different brands.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But Nesco is probably the original. And my mother, she's got to be dead, I'm going to say 18 years. This one was a gift for her shower when she got married.
Oh, wow.
And I've had it fixed once. The thing weighs a ton. It's got the whole stuff inside. The thing is absolutely idiot-proof. I mean, you put something in there, whatever it is, a turkey, you name it, you put it on a little lower than a regular oven, and he put it in there at 250 for 12 hours. It absolutely was to die for.
I've got a pellet unit. I finally broke down and bought one. I've always been, obviously I like the convenience, and as long as the hopper's working and the controller, the controller does its thing, and it, wherever you put it, that's where it stays. And I've always used a kettle, which works just fine. However, go to bed and you may wake up with either raw and ruined or charcoaled and ruined meat, which is very bad. So the regular kettles work great. It's just you have to pay attention to them. There's just no way around.
Well, do you have the? Of course, I bought this for my bro and he hasn't used it yet. There's something called a slow and sear that you put in a kettle. A regular kettle.
Well, there's a number of add-on kind of things. I mean, there's people that make it's basically a PID controller, computerized controller with a fan that plugs in and goes, you put it in the draft door where the draft door is, and attempts to do the same thing. Which sort of works with lump. It is functional. All right, don't get me wrong, but the pellet machine is the one I have can also run all the way up to like 550, so you can actually sear steaks on it, which is great.
Well, this thing he has. Well, he's got the 26-inch Weber, which is hard to find now, but I have one of those too.
Yeah,
but this thing goes on one side, and you put the problem with smoking something in a Weber is you essentially cook it on both sides because this thing stops that because it goes all the way to the bottom and there's about a half inch, three quarter inch channel that you fill with water.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
So it blocks the bottom part and you just put the charcoal on the outside, and you put one of those little thingies, the charcoal stutters, little cube things.
Yeah.
In one corner, and then you put your wood chips on top, and you just light the corner. And what it does?
Yeah,
is,
that's essentially.
Yeah,
that's
moves over. It moves over gradually.
Yeah, that's what I used to do with the kettle. Is that I'd fill it up with lump, but put the chips on top of it, and put a starter over in one little corner of it, and then I had a stone that went over the top. It was a diffuser, so that you didn't end up cooking it too fast. I mean, it absolutely works. You just have to pay attention to it.
Well, that's the
and,
thing. You ever see
yeah,
that?
Yeah, and that's the thing is, if you're doing a brisket, you're talking about a 12-hour plus cook.
See now,
if you're doing a whole one.
If you were to make YouTube videos on this stuff, we'd have to fix you up a little bit, because the guy's there to do it. First, they put the stuff on their smoker. This is early in the morning, and they got their beers, and they got the coveralls and the huge hay face. Then they go out and do shooting practice while the thing is going on. They check on it every time they go up, come back from shooting every hour or so. And then they take a little nap, and somebody else watches it for a couple hours, and they get the whole day figured out.
Well, see that works, except it runs too long. See, so my
favorite. You're drinking beer. You got somebody to help you out when you take a nap. What could be better?
It's not done until like 11 o'clock at night.
Well, they put this on at like 4 o'clock or whatever, 3:30 in the morning, and then you know.
Oh, okay. Well, I put it on at 11 before I go to bed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you know, and like I said, as long as the hopper's full. Bob's your uncle, because the temperature stays exactly where you set it. The smoke keeps going, and you know, you get up in the morning, you check it, and it's like, oh yeah, okay, it's getting about to the stall. It's time to wrap it. Yeah.
Of course, these guys are doing ribs. They weren't doing a 22-pound brisket.
So ribs are a lot faster.
Yeah.
But I mean, the same thing with whole pork shoulders. I do those too. Anyway, the entire point of this. Was that I'm sure you've seen the uproar over Schumer allegedly grilling for Father's Day, although you know he's supposedly the father. It's you know he's got to have his he has to have his diverse family members in the sexual attraction and preference department. As part of the story, right?
Oh,
I mean,
sure.
That's essential. You can't just be, well, you know, we're an ordinary nuclear family, like 90.
Well, I mean, you definitely have a schism between, if you were of that ilk, you're probably not going to vote for Trump.
Well, that's true, okay, but here's the point, all right? There had to be 20 people that were somehow involved in doing this, because... You know, the whole thing's staged like everything else that goes on in D.C.
Sure.
All right. But someone took the picture. Someone else processed it. Someone, you know, then put it up on social media, whatever have you. There were however many of his aides and office people around when this whole thing was staged and put together. Whoever came up with this idea in the first place. All of these individuals saw this, including Schumer himself. Not one of them noticed that... The hamburger was raw, and he put a slice of cheese on top of a raw burger on the grill.
That wouldn't work.
Well, if you're actually stupid enough to cook
now,
only
now
one
wait
side
a minute,
of it,
have you ever? You know, there are people, and I'm not one of them. I'm just saying, there are people that have that love steak tartare.
I did okay, and you know what? Doing this outdoors with paying absolutely no attention to to food safety temperatures and stuff, in the time that you make the steak tartare until you eat it, you're begging for a really nice stay on the throne. Okay, probably going to have a really bad day like that evening or the next day.
I was never a steak tartare fan.
No, I don't like it. I've tried it. I don't care for it. But I had a friend of mine that was very much into it. He liked it. I personally am like, yeah, okay, whatever. So not one of these people, and this is the point, though, Chief, not one of these people actually goes to the grocery store, buys food.
No.
Okay? They don't buy car insurance. They don't pump their own gas, okay, in their car. They probably don't even drive the car. right? They have a driver.
Oh, sure. Well, especially if you're from New York, people don't drive at all.
Well, I'm just saying they don't clean their own. You know, they don't clean their own house. They don't grill their own food. They don't cook their own food. They eat something because everybody has to, but they don't do any of these things. All right, that grill looked like it had never been used. All right, looked like it was brand new. All right.
Probably was. He probably just bought it.
Well, yeah, he bought it, you know, 15 minutes before he staged this photo shoot, right? And so that's the whole point of this is that we have, during this entire process of producing this thing for his PR purposes, nobody among his staff flagged that image and said, "You're crazy." All right? So it's not just the senator, it's also all of the people surrounding him, all of them. And by the way, these are the people who claim that they are representatives of the public.
Oh, I know.
Well, guess what? If you want to know why everything is all screwed in this country, okay, and I don't care what the situation is. You want to argue over immigration, you want to argue over taxation, you want to argue over the insane rampant cost of living over the last, you know, the last, well, 20 years, but really over the last four, all right? And then on top of that, just yesterday, I saw this thing coming across, and I haven't been able to find a mainstream media report on this yet, but there's rumblings. I get some inside baseball from some of the people within the political establishment every now and then. Apparently, rather than go through regular order, which, you know, we're supposed to do to have all these budget bills, around September-ish, right? Because there's this thing called a fiscal year. No. The GOP has decided that we're going to have another CR, and they're going to go along with this, and they're going to do it on the come, rather than do anything about the spending problem, because they think that the odds favor them, which, by the way, mathematically in the Senate anyway, they do, winning in November. Okay, it's just the six-year cycle is that
they did last time, too, and they didn't, which is
well,
weird.
No, actually, last time the math did not favor them in the Senate. The last cycle for the Senate favored the Democrats only by a seat or two, but that's all it takes, right?
Yep.
I mean, you only have to have the majority by one seat. So, no, actually, they all, you know, they were all playing that it was going to be a red wave and blah, 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 blah. Okay, whatever. Whatever you want. However, mathematically, it did not favor them. It's just a question of, you've got the three classes in the Senate and how many Dems and how many Republicans are up in each of the three cycles. And last time around, it favored the Democrats. This time around, it favors the Republicans. So there is mathematically, okay, it doesn't sound like a bad bet. The problem with this is, take a look at the markets, because this is what we try to talk about here, right?
Yep.
You take a look at the markets and what everyone is telling you. I don't care what you're talking about, real estate, stocks, whatever have you. It's all happy days are here again. The Fed's going to cut rates and.
You're blinking in and out, bud. What are you doing? Now you just blinked out.
Yeah, he's still in the meeting, but it's apparently cutting out or something. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, he'll be back.
Oh, by the way, interest rates are going to come down. So
you keep blinking out.
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. I know you're here, but you keep blinking out.
Oh, well, all right. Now Zoom is saying my internet connection is unstable. Well, not according to my stuff. It's not. It must be that eye in the sky that doesn't like what I'm saying.
Wouldn't be a bit surprised. But the cutting of the rates with the market, I guess the problem is the market never really went down. But something happened. I'm going to say 3-4 weeks ago, and I don't know what, and I'm asking you for the answer here. I know it's been a long ways. We've been talking about briskets and everything else, but I mean, somehow, some way, this is not just a couple up days in a row. This is a very serious, all of a sudden, all these companies, the top, not even the top five, the top 50, 60, that people think are going to be here forever, have all of a sudden decided to be valued at 15-20% higher than they are. Every one of them. I mean, it's Oracle, it's CrowdStrike, it's you name it. We're not talking about, right, yesterday was Broadcom. Every one of them, every earnings, even if the earnings suck, the things are up 15-20% after 4 days. I mean, I'm not talking about every single one, but it is. And yet, if you're in any kind of dividend sort of stock, any kind of a regular, if you're in the Russell, you're getting your ass kicked, basically. It's somebody's decided that Microsoft at 14 times revenue is cheap.
I've been noticing it, but here's one of the things that's really dangerous about this. When this kind of divergence happens between the large corporate structures and the smaller, the Russell is the smaller stuff, right?
Yeah.
When this kind of divergence happens, somebody's wrong, and it's usually the guys who are betting on the handful. Right, because the economy, like it or not, is not just the handful. I mean, yes, they're overrepresented. Duh, that's why they're large. But I don't. I think there's some really serious pain headed in our direction, and history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. This looks like 1999 to me.
The last month or two. Looks like summer of 87.
It does, and that's even more scary.
Every guy's in the pit that would do. When I was I stood next to a broker, and I pretty much traded whatever came. I didn't have that much of a conviction, except I tried to buy low and sell high. Guys, the young guys, all they did every morning was sell 20 puts for like months. They made $2,000 a day.
If you look at around on social media in the, with all the, hey, look at me, buy my subscription to, my trading service, right? They're all over the place. I'm seeing that sort of stuff.
Well, yeah, it's right in front of your face, Carl, for day after day after day.
Well, I know, but I'm saying it's to the point now that it's getting obnoxious.
I will never do that because I know the other side of it. But I mean,
yeah, you know what happens when it goes wrong, right?
Yeah, well, but I also know if you stick to your, I'm not going to say this on the air, but if you stick to your 5 or 10 lot, and you get away with it for 6 months, the one day you don't. Problem is, if every time it works, you do a little more the next day.
That's right. That's right. Well, you look at all the people who piled in believing that this. Whoever this whole kitty thing, that the GameStop was all of a sudden going to go to 150, okay, and it's trading 24.8 right now. Now if you were the poor SOB that bought it at 67.5,
yeah, do we know whether he sold his calls or he exercised them?
Apparently he exercised.
How do you know?
Is this a spreadsheet? Okay.
Yeah, it's not your sheets from PTI or Merrill Lynch or somebody.
Well, one of my problems with all of this stuff is that I've pointed this out all the way back to before the crash. I said, look, if these guys that are running these tout sheets, are so good, if they really have figured this out, okay, if you found a way, some kind of system, I don't care what it is. It only works as long as nobody else knows about it. Because once it gets wide acceptance, the arbitrage opportunity that you've discovered disappears. You'll get arbed out of it. It happens every time. It's just the reason it works is because you are smarter than the other guy. That's why it works. All right? When there's no other guy, because, everybody else is doing it, it stops working. Because the movement gets anticipated, that's the way markets are. It's the way they've always been. So if you find something like this, you would use it to make $1 billion, and you'd be crazy to tell anybody about it.
Well, I mean, it becomes a matter.
Somebody's going to figure it out,
right?
Okay.
But I've been around this option education stuff for God longer than I care to admit, but. There's timing patterns on all this stuff. There's people.
Of course, there is.
There's people who did. They call them iron butterflies. They're really not.
Iron condors.
Same thing. Kind of, I mean, yeah. But The what basically you're selling out of the money call spreads and put spreads. Now, right. in a channeling market, which we had for, you know, sometimes we have for 4 or 5 years, you know, that strategy is all over the place. And because, by the way, it pretty much always works for that 5 year period.
Then, right.
Then all of a sudden you blow through to the upside. Okay, well, that's once. Then all of a sudden you blow through the downside, and everybody says, we don't want to do that strategy anymore. Then all of a sudden it comes back. But you don't see anybody. I mean, I'm going to say that for periods of time, the covered call strategy works for a decade. And all of a sudden, boy, if you're covered calling those QQQs, you're chasing them every damn day. I know, because we are.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is up, we're talking about it's up 30 points in what, 3 weeks? I mean, we're talking about 1.5%. I mean, if the NASDAQ does the same as it has for the last week, and you're not supposed to do this, if you extend it out a year, Carl, it's going to more than double. We're talking 1.5% a day. It used to take a year.
Well, but the thing is this, is that, and if you look at 1999, okay, into the first couple months of 2000, it did.
Sure.
All right, and the number of people that I had that were telling me that I was crazy not to jump on this train, I can't even count them. Right?
You were crazy not to jump on it early and jump off the last day.
Well, yeah, the problem is figuring out when the last day is, right? I mean, that's always the issue, but what I keep seeing in the pattern here is this pattern and how it ends has been repeated time and time again, and the trigger is always something different, right? It's always something. You're never going to look at it and say, well, you know, we got to the same place in valuation that we did the last time, therefore, you know, it's time to get out of this thing and, you know, sit it out.
Or we're way beyond that.
We're way beyond that.
But
my thing in 1998, late 98 and 99, was I sat out the entire thing because I knew I didn't know what was going to set it off, but I did know that it was going to blow up.
Well, there were a couple of big differences, though. I mean, you got to look at, you know, history repeats. Most of the crazy dot bombs were companies that you never heard of. They weren't in the OEX. I mean, some of them were. I mean, Oracle and
Cisco. Well, they weren't in the OEX, but they also didn't make any money.
Right. But now we're talking. These are stocks that have been around. I mean, for Oracle, that can't get out of its own way for how many decades. For that thing to be up 15-20% in 2 weeks on crummy earnings, you sit there and go, where did that come from?
Yeah, what's this?
It's all right. Because now, you know, the Nvidia is somewhat unique in that it is actually growing at that speed. But Apple is up. I'm going to say, where the hell is it today? Apple is up another buck. It's trading 217. It was 194. I'm going to say 10 trading days ago. Right, so that's $23. You know how many shares are Apple are outstanding?
Oh yeah,
$15 billion. It's $350 billion in market cap in 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's utterly insane.
It's insane, but how many? The fact is, it's going up. And
but the fact is, it's happening. Right.
Something. The reason why a long time to get there. We don't have that much time. What's the song? Something's happening here. What it isn't exactly clear. I think you're going to see a big bulge in the money supply this month. And it's happening. Something is going. This is not just a bunch of goofballs seeing stocks going up and chasing them. I mean, it's fun. There's some combination of, I mean, if somebody sends me a check this week, which a lot of times they do, and even if I say, well, let's put, you know, 30% of it in, even if we, you know, put some in T-bills or something, we maybe are being very conservative, the person's older or something, whatever. Let's put 30% in the SPY.
Yeah.
Guess what I'm doing? I'm
the You're driving it. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to 150 grand if it's going in those five stocks.
Well,
you can't get away from it, Carl.
No, I understand that, Chief. But look, a column I put up yesterday on the whole AI craze. All right, which is you know, the thing du jour, right? It's what's driving all this. There's, and I cut my teeth on a Burroughs bookkeeping machine at punch cards, right? And with the bookkeeping machine, I mean, I put a link to the picture of the thing. Right? This is my dad's shop where he worked, and I have never seen, over all the years since, I've never seen a computer, I don't care who makes it, that fundamentally works any differently than that one did.
Well, they don't.
Right?
They don't.
They don't. And that's just the reality of it. All right. And so the problem with all of this is that, and I saw a lot of this when I was running my company, the amount of power that gets consumed by these things, and then you have to pay again because it generates heat, you got to get it out of the room or it melts. There isn't a revenue model behind this so-called innovation. And by the way, this so-called innovation is not intelligent. It's actually just a sieve. It's a very fast sieve, but that's all it is. That's all it's ever been. And there's no evidence that it's ever going to be anything different than that at all, anywhere.
Well, Carl, we got a dash, but I'm gonna lob this one at you. The AI is the face of the rally. The driver of the rally is money in the system.
Well, I understand that, but when the realization comes that all these people have been had, the flight out of there, the people are going to realize the curtains are on fire, and by the way, the door only fits one dude at a time.
Well, that's the problem. If you start selling your spiders, even if you like these stocks, you're selling 50% of your money in those stocks.
All right, yep, exactly.
But right now, I mean, there is no question that in the last 10 days, now we can't trade the last 10 days, if you would have bought the every time I came in the morning, if I'd have bought a NASDAQ future, I'd have made money.
Yep. And I understand
that. A lot of money.
That.
I mean, we went from down 10 yesterday to up 300. I mean, we're not talking about down 10 to up 20. I mean,
I know. And I've seen this and I'm going, what?
Well, it'll take 20 minutes for the NASDAQ to drop like 5 points, and all of a sudden it's up 40 while you're on the phone with somebody.
Yeah, I know.
Well, let's talk about it Friday, bud. Don't forget, Wednesday we're off. We got the Juneteenth, no markets. But then again, it's 95 degrees in Chicago, so we got that to look forward to.
Well, it's 95 degrees here, too, and it's not a lot of fun. I got to get my run in before I gross.
Well, good luck, bud. SP Futures down 1, NASDAQ Futures up 26. Be right back, Mr. Joel O'Connor.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello, welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. Tom Howe, Ricardo on the board. SP Futures down 1. NASDAQ Futures up 28. They can't possibly be down. Dow Futures down 34. I don't really see any individual stocks going crazy. Apple, of course, is up again, 123. Now we're going to drive Apple to some crazy valuation, but that's what we do. And maybe it won't be crazy. Who knows? But over in Europe, we've got the... as soon as my machine wants to move here. All right, Ricardo, maybe you should do traffic weather. There we go. European markets are up a little bit. DAX up 47.2. FTSE up 26.3. CAC round up 40.4. So the CAC round's actually come back a little bit the last couple days, but they were really down last week with it's kind of the crazy political situation they've got over there. Over in Asia, Nikkei has been volatile. Nikkei's made a bounce back here, 379, 1%. Remember, they were down 2%, like Monday. The Hang Seng down 20.1%, 17,915 under 18,000, and I didn't think that was going to happen. Shanghai up 14 to 3,030, so they've managed to escape dropping below 3,000, at least for now. Bonds up 1 basis point, 4.29. The Bund up 1, 2.42. Japan up 2.95. Maybe it'll get back over 1%. Maybe it won't. Oil up up a penny, 80.34. So it's back up over 80. The top end of the range has been around 81. We'll see if it breaks out or if it hangs there. Brent unchanged, 84.25. Natural gas up a penny, 280. RBOB unchanged, 244. Gold is down 4 bucks, 23.25. So we're down 13 cents, 29.26. So gold all of a sudden is kind of lost in this 23, 2320 to 2360 area. Copper down 5 cents, 439. So copper's pretty steady run up has kind of stopped here. Not sure what that is all about. Usually means some kind of recession, but I don't know if that's going to happen. U.S. dollar has been strong, still at 107 on the euro, 126.7 on the British pound. We've got Bitcoin down another 1,500, 65,168. What do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports? If I'm not here tomorrow, Ricardo, it's because I'm closing for the Cubs. They need somebody.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 6:36 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. Looking at 77 degrees right now with a high of 89. Breezy and very, very warm with partial sunshine. An afternoon thunderstorm in a couple of spots. So check on sensitive groups and those without air conditioning like myself. Tonight we got breezy this evening. Otherwise very warm with patchy clouds. A little relief from the heat with a low of 75 degrees. Over to Phoenix, we got 81 degrees right now with a high of 104. Plenty of sunshine, but there is an excessive heat wash. So be mindful of that. And tonight will be clear with a low of 79 degrees. On the traffic in Chicago, inbound Kennedy from Monroe, you're looking at 17 minutes. 38 minutes inbound Edens from Lane Cook. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf, 25 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 19 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan is going to be 24 minutes. On the sports MLB yesterday, the Giants beat the Cubs 7-6. And we got a few games today too. We have another game of the Giants playing the Cubs at 7:05 p.m. here in Chicago at Wrigley Field. The White Sox play the Astros as well at 7:10 p.m. in Guaranteed Rate Field. And the Diamondbacks play the Nationals in Washington at 5:45 p.m. The NBA Finals Game 5 was yesterday. The Celtics are the NBA champions, taking 4 out of the 5 games. Game 5 was 106-288 for the Celtics. And the Stanley, finally, the Stanley Cup Final Game 5 is going to be today. Oilers play the Panthers in Florida at 7 p.m. And that's all I got for you, Chief.
Do we have Joel?
Yeah, we do, Chief. Good morning.
Joel, what's up, bud? So we should buy our futures in the NASDAQ the second the show's over, and then we make another, you know, 200 every day?
Or maybe yesterday, or the day before, or the day before, or the day before.
Yeah, or, you know, the day before. What do you make of this? Just to give you an example, we put a we weren't short any calls for any of our clients, and I didn't really want to be. I want to be a little longer, right? So we put on some kind of one diagonal 1x2s where we actually were long in the spreads, and I think the Qs were at right about here, 199, and we did like the 202s, 203s, so you know we're pretty far out of the money. Same way with the Qs, it was like 460 something, and we sold the 475s, and well now the Qs are 486. $10 in the money, three days, and then the Russell is the other way. It's 199. We made money on the Russell, but only the credit we put in there because it just got destroyed.
Right.
And meanwhile, the Qs, one is down 4%, and the other's up 8 in 4 days. I mean, that's I don't know what to call it, but it's crazy.
It is. I mean, there's a lot of crazy moves going on right now. I mean, all you need to do is announce a 10-for-1 stock split. You see what happened to NVIDIA and now Broadcom. You know, there's certain inflection points in the markets, right, that I'd like to try and focus on. And one of them is QuadWitch expirations. And that's what's coming up on Friday. So there's major turning points in the markets, you know, around these events. It's either a strong continuation of the trend, which right now is very apparent, or you get a sharp reversal. So, as you know, as far as like the old, you know, individual stocks, it's different. But from the indexes, I mean, we're just in blue sky territory here, just with no resistance. So, I mean, I know what the strategy, you know, that you're talking about, you know, with, you know, selling the calls is not something I've employed a lot for my long-term portfolio, but it's an incredible move, and to try and predict when it's going to turn is very hard. But I would just say you do have an important event coming up on Friday.
What do you sense? The sense there's an expiration every day, other than you and some of us old timers, does anybody even know what QuadWitch is?
Well, the people that listen to pre-market prep do.
Well, people
sure
listen here do, but I'm saying in general.
Yeah, no. I you know what? I think you make a good point there. It's certainly not the event that it was once. It's been certainly diluted with, you know, with the DTEs and stuff like that. But what you also have to take into account is that, you know, some of the big boys, you know, still abide by it, right? Institutions rebalancing and things like that. So you're right. It's not as much of an event as it was, but it's still, and not that many people know about it. With all the action on the dailies and whatever, half dailies or quarter dailies. Yeah, it's definitely been diminished over the years.
Well, we were talking with Carl a little bit about similarities with 1999 that he brought up. I think the difference is that the companies that are moving now are way bigger and more established than the companies were in 99. I mean, mm-hmm. we're talking about, again, he's not my favorite, but Kramer basically asked the question a few weeks ago. I happened to hear him when I was walking through the lobby. Is the valuation that people are throwing on NVIDIA essentially going to cross to other places? I mean, we're talking, $300 billion market cap in Apple in the last 2 weeks. Same thing in Oracle, which to me was like it's been a dead dog for how long. You see it in CrowdStrike. You see it every one of these stocks that is kind of that people like is in play. Even some of your big retailers, you know, the Home Depots, the people are survivors or something. I've never seen a company. Well, I've never seen a company the size of Microsoft, but I've never seen one that size trading for 15 times revenue. I mean, I that's unconscionable. Yet, I don't want to short it either.
Yeah, there's your... I mean, I think if one thing that you're seeing in this market is the haves and the have-nots. And I think if you're a small cap fan, the news that you got last week for inflation and then what you saw in the performance of the IWM and its related components makes you think that like they're just throwing in the towel on the catch-up trade, even with, you know, the aura of lower interest rates. So there's just such rotation and there's just such, you know, the favored stocks, of, you know, that are loved and the others are hated. There's a lot of ugly charts out there, right? You look at some of these industrials have fallen off significantly from their all-time highs. Steel stocks, you got a couple warnings here over the last week or so. But the money's going where the money's being made, and that's in the technology, the chip stocks. And you talk about the valuations, Chief, and we talked about it when I was on last week, and we were like, how long can it persist? And here we are a week later, and even those levels even more exaggerated. So very interesting, time in the markets. A lot of the markets exceeded, you know, the expectations and targets of many, many analysts. So Trent, you know, if you're hitting targets out there and your investment objectives, and you know, maybe take a look at and trimming your portfolio. If you're a young buck, then you know you ride the wave, and you get run over.
Well, I reached the point, and I shouldn't even really be like this. I don't believe anything the government's telling me. It looks to me like they're pouring money in, like during COVID, the last 3 weeks. And since we don't get the weekly money supply numbers, I don't think, let's put it this way, they didn't fire the guy who calculates them, right? Somebody's still getting them. It's just not us. I wouldn't be a bit surprised. You know, I almost want to be, you know, slap people in cuffs if at the end of the month you find out that, or when we finally find out about the money supply this month, that it doesn't have a big bulge to the upside. Well, if you and I knew that, we'd be long everything, wouldn't we?
I try and be that way anyways.
Yeah. I mean, really long everything. I mean, really long everything. I mean, I wouldn't. Yeah. Why would I even?
Yeah. I mean, the only thing is if that's true, then, you know, the inflation numbers are not going to continue to improve. And, you know, that's been the bugaboo in the market. So we'll have to see.
Well, the unadjusted number last month was 0.2, which is what everybody was looking for. Somebody adjusted it down to even. Who the hell is the somebody? Where does that adjustment come from?
I don't know.
Why not just tell us it's down 10%? Maybe we'll believe that too.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, buddy. Take care of yourself.
Go blue. Talk next week.
Do we have Mr. Polcari?
I don't see him in the meeting, actually. We still got Carl, though.
Carl, why don't you come back until Kenny pops in if you're still there, bud? if we can find him.
I am still here. You have to give me a second. Put the headphones up. Oh, there we go. I think I see Kenny coming in.
Oh, Kenny comes in?
Yeah, Kenny's in.
All right, Bud, how are you? We didn't go to break.
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. You know, so what? You were pissed off last week that you guys were so hot and we weren't that you sent us some heat?
You're killing me. No, I wasn't pissed off at all last week, you know what I mean? I think it's been an amazing time. Yesterday was another amazing performance. I never expected that. I don't think a lot of people did. But, you know, when you get Evercore comes out and suddenly goes from 4,700 to 6,000 on the S&P by year end, and Goldman follows suit and goes to 5,600, and, you know, everyone's citing five names in the tech industry is going to carry the world. I think that to me is almost kind of, it's almost laughable, and it almost to me screams, okay, this is the top.
Well, that used to be whenever the market got on Time Magazine, it was the top, right?
Yeah, every time. But that's what it felt like yesterday, you know, that, I mean, Evercore was down at, I think they were at 4,750. So they made a dramatic change in their outlook, which is okay, but I think I think it's a little too late. I think it's an aggressive move. I'm not really sure why it was that aggressive. Even JP Morgan is still at 4,260. They are by far the weakest link in terms of where they think the S&P is going to be at year end. That's a 23% decline from where we are right now. And JP Morgan has not seemed to move. I wonder, though, if these moves yesterday by Evercore and Goldman are going to cause someone to rethink their outlook at JP Morgan or not.
We might be having the take of two markets here, Kenny. We might be seeing the Fed pouring money in for the election, and maybe thinking of pulling it out, which would be a big difference between November, whenever, and the end of the year.
Exactly right. So, you know, JoJo better hope that JJ keeps this party going until November 5th, because if we suffer, you know, some substantial downturn either midsummer or early fall, the way the markets are always skittish in the fall anyway, August, September, October can be a skittish time for the market. If the market decides, you know, it's time to have that pullback because it's done nothing but go straight up, I think, JoJo and the Dems will not be happy with that.
Well, no. I mean, it's up so much. I don't even know where you – can they keep it going to November is the question. I think these companies
– well, they can keep it going if they could – continue to stimulate, if they, you know, pull back on quantitative tightening, I guess they could continue to kind of push it, right? I think what was interesting, one of Goldman's comments, and the reason for the upgrade was because companies are so adept at managing costs and growing margins. Well, they're growing margins because they keep raising prices. That's how they're growing margins.
Well, right? Yeah, and it seems like the regular citizen has zero voice at all. I mean, and that's just part of it. And I think the more they get away with it, Kenny, the more emboldened they get.
Well, I think you're right, which is why, you know, what we really need, and I hate to say it like this, but the truth is we really need a good correction. You got to shake the branches a little bit. You got to get people a little bit nervous, because right now no one's nervous. Everyone's like, oh, throw a dart at any stock and it's going to go up. That's the way it feels. And as much as, look, I'm invested, you're invested, my clients are invested, everybody's enjoying this ride up. But I say to my clients, this is exactly why you need to have a plan and you need to be well diversified, because the day is going to come when these tech stocks get, you know, it'll be the tech wreck all over again.
I don't, you know, the thing, as you know, Kenny, I do the same thing. I mean, I'm managing people's money, but this whole idea, I mean, I love the idea of diversification, and I love the idea that I'm in the indexes, and that's why I'm in there. But I'm not getting any diversification here. I mean, if I put 100 grand for somebody like I did 4 days ago, in the queues, yep, I'm buying 50 grand of the same stocks I think are too high. Well,
okay, so then if you're already in the stock, if you're in those stocks, then that's not where people should go, right? That's what I tell people all
but
the
how,
time.
But how do you? We have a group of clients.
Well, you got to diversify into the other sectors.
Okay,
right?
But we have
staples, utilities, energy.
All right, utilities have gotten their ass kicked. We got a whole group of clients that.
That's how you have to get your diversification. You can't keep the IGV, the IGM. They're all the same stocks, just in different weightings. Right. Look at the IGM and the IGT and the
same
names.
I get it, but I'm saying, next time a client comes in, I want you sitting next to me when I recommend all the stuff that's down and not the stuff that's up.
I know, dude. Listen, the same thing happens to me, so I get it. I completely understand. But then you have to show them, right? I mean, I show them what in-depth analysis. I show them what, if you tweak it, if we do this, if we do that, what it means for the portfolio, what the risk is, how much the risk goes up, what you're willing to lose, what you're willing to gain. You know, you can model that and show them the different decisions that they want to make. This decision, we're suggesting this, they want to do that, here's what happens. Here's what, you know, potentially happens to the portfolio if the market does a downturn. This portfolio is going to get whacked. Your portfolio, for instance, is going to go back. You know, and so it's just it's part of the conversation. And look, ultimately, it's their money. And yeah, ultimately, it's, you know,
without a doubt.
If they say, this is what I want, okay, this is what you want.
Well, then you try and say, well, let's at least protect it a little bit, which we can
agreed.
Do.
Yeah, agreed. So you have to offer some, you know, some protection. Okay. You have to at least explain to them why you're offering protection.
I'm a little... You're the person I can ask. I mean, everybody, I can ask everybody, but you have a, it seems to, we've seen rallies that sort of didn't make a whole lot of sense in the dot-bomb stuff. We've seen rallies, you know, other rallies after that, that all of a sudden one day it's too high and everybody goes down. I mean, obviously 87 was one of those times, 89. They were all over the place. I don't know that I've ever seen anything quite like this that, because I do these all through the earnings season, we do these earnings plays, and so I'm way more cognizant of most of what the straddles are on the days the earnings come out. And when I say the straddles, if a stock's trading 200, if you look at the calls and the puts and add them up on that day, if the 200 calls and puts add up to $20, it'll tell you that the market feels that the stock, based on its volatility, has a chance of moving $20. And most of the time, or not most of the time, but a real lot of times, they're right. It'll move, you know, 15, it'll move 16, it might move 22, or maybe it might not move at all. They're not always right. But I've never seen this much on stocks, and because we had a position in Oracle. I thought we had a nice winner, and all of a sudden, the guy comes out and he gives some BS about AI, and even though the revenue and the earnings didn't miss, the thing's up like 20%. So and I got to the point where every single one of them now is blowing through the straddle by a factor of 40, 50%. And every one of them's to the upside. It's somehow, some way, somebody has decided that these stocks are all 15%, 20% too cheap. And to me, the only way that can happen is if the Fed opened up the purse. I mean, I don't see that happening any other time, really, ever, of stocks this size. I mean, Apple is up what, $300 billion in market cap in 10 trading days. That didn't happen because they decided to sell more iPhones.
No, correct.
I mean, what is it, Kenny? What is the memo that everybody got but us?
Well, I don't know about you. I'm still long my Apple, so I'm having a great time.
Oh, yeah, fine. Yeah, well, I am too for all my people. We haven't, up until last week when we did this, like, on a kind of one by two, we haven't sold any calls and any of this stuff. We had a fabulous year for our guys.
I think it's this ongoing narrative, reiterated, by the way, by Neil Kashkari on Sunday on Face the Nation. When he finally called, he put a December time date on a rate cut by the Fed, saying that, you know, while they're still waiting for data, it seems that December is reasonable. And so he offered clarity, right? He took kind of the speculation out. So forget July and September. Let's just move beyond that. Let's focus on December. That's when the first cut's coming. And one cut doesn't define a trend, but the fact is that the move is down and not up, and that's really the key, right?
The only problem with that is we've been up the whole way they raise rates.
Agreed, which is why I say I don't think there's any reason to cut it off. We are kissing new highs and making new highs, and rates are 5.25%, and they've been there for 14 months. And so everybody who says, oh, my God, rates are so usurious, oh, it's restricting, it's choking the economy. Where do you see the choke in the economy? I don't see the choke at all.
Well, I think there is a... There is some choke, and everybody's got a small business.
Well, I even wonder about that because are the small businesses going out of business at a rapid rate? Because if they are, I'm missing that data point.
So, by the way, I'm looking here at M2 Money Supply, and we're talking about a group that is allegedly fighting inflation tooth and nail, right? From October 2023 to today, we are up $200 billion. How's that fighting inflation?
We're $200 billion, so there you go.
Yeah.
Right? It's not fighting inflation. That's exactly the point. And this is gonna be the point, because you and I both know this.
you know, and I keep saying it, what I'm afraid of is, A, I don't think they need to cut rates, number one. But if they do, they're just gonna reinvigorate the monster. And it's going to be 1981 all over again, where it's going to turn its ugly head up, and then it's going to spin out of control again, and the Fed's going to be forced to go in the opposite direction, but much more aggressively than they did. And I think that's what I'm worried about, and that's where I think then we're going to see, you know, the market correct, because at that point the market will correct, right?
Well, Kenny, I actually did a little bit of which I shouldn't do. You don't ever do any research. All it does is screw you up. February of 2022, the interest rates were 0.08
in the
S&P, the spider closed at 436.
Right.
In May of 2024, which is quite close to today, the rates are 5.33, and the spider was 527. And guess what? After the last 2 weeks, it's 547. It's up 25% while we're raising rates. How much can the world stand there with their tongue hanging out waiting for the first quarter point cut? You'd want it to keep going up, for God's sake. All it's done is go up. Why don't we go the other way?
Right, but the data also says that the market actually corrects when the Fed starts to cut rates.
Right.
Partly because the impression is, and this is where it's all going to come down to the narrative, is the Fed cutting rates because they're afraid that they've pushed too far and the economy's going over the edge and now we're going to recession? Is that why they're cutting rates? Is that why the market's going to back off? Or can they manage the narrative and say, no, everything is great, the economy's strong, and inflation is on its way down, and we can afford to cut rates? That's a different story, although I don't think they're going to be able to carry that story, because I don't think inflation, in fact, is going to go down. I think it's going to remain sticky at this 3+% rate, 3.2, 3.3, I think, and it's in the stuff that we need. It's utilities, it's food, it's gasoline, it's energy. Look at energy. It was up almost 3% yesterday. Yeah. It's trading back over $80 a barrel, you know, probably going higher. Suddenly, 2 weeks ago, it was all about, waning demand and oversupply. And last night, Goldman and RBC, Halima Croft, come out and says, oh, no, this summer they're going to draw down inventories, driving demand and boating demand and airplane demand. And all this demand is going to take all the fluff out of the supply, and oil's going higher.
Well,
right? And so it's interesting just to see how this is going to play out. But I do think that the Fed, JoJo's going to have to beg the Fed to stay on this path in order to help him in November.
Well, I'm not going to ask you to agree with me on the lie part, but roll with me for a second. How long can we maintain the lie? I mean, the idea that the inflation from the start of COVID has been 18-19% when it's probably been 40. I mean, can we continue? I mean, just in terms of how the CPI works, because I honestly don't know how these guys calculate the stuff. Can we really say for the next decade that rents are up 20% when they're up 50? I mean, or is it going to come creeping through the numbers someday when there maybe aren't even any increases, or is it something we can just bury forever? Or can we say that? I guess I'll let you answer the question I just asked you. Go ahead.
I don't think that they can keep the lie going forever. Like everything, it all comes out in the laundry, right? It all comes out in the wash at some point. It all comes out in the wash, whether it's 2 years from now, 3 years from now. Look, just like the transitory argument, right? They carried that argument for a year. Oh, it's transitory. Don't worry about it. We got it. No problem. And suddenly inflation went to 9%. And they go, I guess it wasn't transitory. Well, guess what? You and I knew it wasn't transitory. We lived it every day. They kept shoving it down our throat that we were wrong and they were right and it was just transitory until it wasn't, right? And so now I think that's the point. They're going to try to shove it down our throat, tell us. Meanwhile, the people that are living it every day recognize that what they're saying is in fact not true.
Except we have no power. What can we do about it?
Well, it's hard to fight, right?
Well, they tell us that I believe, Kenny. I mean, that's when you talk about the word recession. I shudder, because the money they put in the system, we're never going to have a nominal recession,
right?
I mean, how could we? Because for every guy who can't afford a $2 beer, there's a guy buying a $10 beer because he's got the dough.
That's right.
We've blown every economic thing out of proportion.
Listen, when the yield curve inverted, by the way, in the winter of 2021, or 2022, I guess, when it inverted. We were supposed to, you know, recessions typically start somewhere 14 to 16 months after that. We're now 24 or 28 months beyond that initial inversion, and we still don't have a recession.
Well,
and nor is there, and they keep talking about, well, maybe in 2025. Oh, really? It's not happening. They're not going to let it happen right now.
Well, Kenny,
we'll wait till, to your point, after the election.
You know, when we learned in school, we got a dash here. We learned like addition and subtraction and stuff. Then they wanted to do this.
Yeah.
Then they decided to go with this new math.
Yeah.
Well, when you have a COVID situation,
come up with your own answer.
Yeah.
Right? The new math lets you come up with your own answer.
How exactly, when we shut the entire economy down, did they come up with maybe two quarters of a recession when we were in a friggin' depression for a year and a half? If you take that math forward. If that was a recession, I got news for you. I'm Rock Hudson. I mean, really? You know, I should be pitching for the Cubs tonight. I mean, what are we talking about? We're not even on the same planet.
Yeah, no kidding.
So everything good? So you guys are at least sort of used to the heat. I was telling Ricardo on the way in.
Actually, the weather down here has been beautiful, quite honestly. I was just sitting outside talking to you. It's only about 75 degrees
good,
here.
Good for you.
Gorgeous, though. Nice breeze. It's beautiful.
I was telling Ricardo on the way in, he's a younger guy. I said, you know, in 1957, the record we broke, virtually no, all those houses had really small bedrooms because all you did in your bedroom was basically sleep. You had big rooms, and all the other rooms were big.
Right.
Nobody had any air conditioning. And married couples had a double bed. I said, if that wasn't true love, could you imagine that today? A double bed, no AC, sleeping with somebody?
Oh my God, not in a million.
God, and plus, they didn't even have ceiling fans. They weren't even invented yet. I mean, oh God. Anyway, Kenny, stay cool, buddy. Enjoy yourself, and we'll talk to you next week. Tomorrow we're off, We're off, so no trading.
We're off. It's a holiday.
SP futures down 75 cents, and the Nasdaq futures up 26. Be right back, Professor Hill.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now.
Hear ye, hear ye. The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air.
Rolling off big Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Ricardo on the board. SP Futures down a buck. Chuck, Nasdaq Futures up 27. Individual stacks not doing all that much. We've got Apple's up a little bit. Well, it was up a buck. Now it's up 89 cents. But we have a holiday tomorrow. Microsoft's down a buck. We got Meta down a buck 60. So nothing kind of crazy. In the Dow, I don't really see anything moving more than a dollar. So far, we're kind of quiet. You know, actually, I got Merck is up a buck 63. Merck is a... They've been moving. They've got one of the new drugs that are coming out, so they've actually been doing pretty well. Do we have the professor, Professor Hal?
Hey, good morning, Tom.
How are you, buddy?
Doing all right.
I hope you've sold all your shares and everything else, and you've just put them in the five or six stops, and now you're wealthy beyond the dreams of avarice.
Yeah, I wish I'd done that.
Yeah, it's a crazy stuff. Huh? What do you think is going on all of a sudden when you see valuations up? And this is across the board. This isn't just a few people deciding to buy some shares. I mean, this is a lot of it is there's tremendous amount of mutual fund buying. I mean, the public is all in on this. And you can tell this on the close. Up until last night, I'm going to say the last seven or eight closes have been seriously the upside. Give me a second, Helen. For those of you that don't, mutual funds, obviously there's still amazingly popular in 401ks and so forth. Matter of fact, they're probably the only things that are in the 401ks. Now, the reasons for ETFs versus mutual funds, I haven't mentioned this in a while, Hal, so bear with me for a minute or two. If you decide you want to, today you go, man, this market looks pretty hot, I'm going to buy, you know, put myself in a mutual fund, and you call your guy up, or you go online, showing my age, and you say you want to put $20,000 in a mutual fund. Well, you don't make the trade then. They will buy the stocks on the close that day if they have net. Now, there's people that are going to be redeeming, and some people are buying. But you know, I think generally now the buy side is probably bigger. Well, whatever the balance is, they do on the close. So if the market is down at 10 o'clock and you decide to buy, and at the end of the day it's some screaming rally, you're getting the end of the day price, not when you think it was down, or vice versa. I mean, you could have decided to sell your mutual fund, or maybe had to, or wanted to buy a house and say, okay, I need the money for me. You could tell them you wanted to sell it at 10 o'clock when the market's down, and you're going to get the high of the day on the close. So it's not like it's necessarily rigged for one side or the other. It just is what it is. Now, an ETF, on the other hand, one of the reasons for the popularity is when you trade it, that's your price during the day. So the difference between a Vanguard 500 S&P 500 fund and the Spider is, if I buy the Spider this morning, I'm going to get the Spider right at that price that second. So when you see mutual fund buying, it means that at the end of the day, the Vanguards of the world, of which there's a gazillion of them, generally have checks piling up on their desk and they have to buy stuff on the close. So when you see this close in the run up in the last 10-15 minutes, it generally means there's mutual fund buying, or the other way, mutual fund selling, but we haven't seen that in a while. So when you see this in the afternoon, it means the public is still putting money into the market. And even people that you may run into at the local bar, local coffee shop, local library, whatever it is, local church, say, man, I'm so bearish, I can taste it. Chances are, if that person has a job and has a 401k plan, despite the fact that he or she's telling you how bearish they are, they're buying stock as they speak. So it becomes automatic, right? And I think there's some of that. People are just automatically, and it's a good thing. People should own, should invest, should have pieces, but at the same time, the same person who says that they are insanely bearish, and there's not that many people goes around, that's insanely bearish on the market, is generally not the same person that goes online and says, take my money out of my stocks, and by the way, put it in a money market fund for the next 6 months. So a lot of times people's opinion don't match their trading. Does it help?
Yeah. Well, what is the long-run average return on an S&P 500 if you just bought an ETF?
Now, wait. You know better than that. You're a highly mathematized professor. The buy and hold theory is completely how well you've done is when you bought and when you held to.
Exactly, yeah.
Why do you think just about all calculations start with the day after the 29 crash and not the day before?
Yeah.
Because it's a different number, right?
it's a
real different number. So most people would say with dividends, what it's going back away. I'm going to say that most people would say that the S&P returns with dividends 5-7% a year. Now, of course, there's been decades when it hasn't moved at all, but still you got your dividends, and there's some times when it's been down, but some of the stocks go in and out, which is a little bit of an issue. I mean, if you would have had 10 stocks in 2007 that you thought were safe, they were reasonably big in the S&P, they're all out of business, right?
Yeah.
You know, so you got to be careful.
If you look at Investopedia, I'm not sure how accurate it is, but it's saying it's about 9-10% annually.
Since when?
Yeah. So it's saying 9-10%. If inflation is closer to, 6-7%, if we go with M2 growth, the real return is about maybe 2-3%.
If you're in the index.
Yeah.
But now, you need to be, quote, in the index. If you'd have bought the same 100 stocks in the OEX 20 years ago, probably 10 of them were bankrupt.
Yeah.
So you always got to be careful, Carl. Nobody knows that more than you as a professor. Wait a minute. We got to ask all the questions here, right?
Yeah, there's all kinds of churn in these indices, right? All kinds of churn. I think if you look at the original Dow, there might be one left of the original Dow?
I don't think there's any.
No, really? Okay, yeah.
I think the last one was...
For a long time, there was just one left.
The last one left, I believe, was GE.
Yeah, then there'd be zero, yeah. So there's quite a bit of churn in these indices, yeah.
Well, how many of them are industrials?
Yeah. I don't think any of them are. I think they need to change.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you got... Let me run down the list here. You've got Amgen.
Well, they're mostly tech companies now, right?
Well, Amgen's a how many times have people even looked at these Amgen's drugs, right? American Express,
yeah.
Amazon, Apple. I guess you could say that's somewhat of an industrial. Boeing surely is. Caterpillar is. Cisco, maybe. They do routers and stuff. Chevron, Texaco, I'd say yes. Goldman Sachs, no. Home Depot, it's a retailer. Honeywell, they're industrial. IBM, probably. Intel, not so much. Johnson & Johnson, another drug company. Coke, another retailer of some kind. J.P. Morgan's a bank. McDonald's is a burger joint. 3M's an industrial. Merck is a high-end, I think you have to put a big pharmacy company in there, don't you? Microsoft, I guess you could say, is, I wouldn't exactly call it an industrial, but something. Nike, another retailer. Procter & Gamble, I'd say another retailer. Travelers, an insurance company. United Health, another healthcare thing. Salesforce, not an industrial. Verizon, not an industrial. Visa, and Walmart, and then Disney. Those are your Dow 30.
Yeah. Well, they used to be like railroad companies.
Well, no, they were always in transportation average.
Yeah.
But I mean, GM used to be in the Dow.
Sugar, tobacco, gas, distilling, cattle feed.
Exxon, I believe, used to be in there, and they're not. So they used to have two oil companies, now they got one. So but GE certainly. I think GE was the oldest, one of the original ones.
Yeah, it was. General Electric was one of the originals, yeah.
And I don't think any of the rest of them are.
Yeah. Mostly, I mean, a third of them are retail.
Yeah.
A few are tech companies. Is there anyone that you could say that's a traditional industrial company?
Well, yeah, I would say Boeing is.
Okay.
I would say Boeing, 3M probably is. I'd say Caterpillar surely is.
I think they need to change their name to better represent what the 30 represent now.
Well, they want the stocks that are hot. I bet you're going to get, after the split, I'm a bit surprised you don't see NVIDIA in there. Right? I mean, you want to market your index.
Yeah. They need to come up with a better name, because industrial doesn't really line up with the way the powers that be want to move the economy. They want to move it to a green economy, right? So industrial kind of harkens images of, smokestacks and black soot on white bark, which changed nature. The white moths were selected out and the black moths survived, and then when the economy started cleaning up, the bark returned to being white. Selected out the black moths, and the white moths came back. So I think maybe they need to come up with a new name, because that's what I think of when I think of industrial, right?
Well, actually,
I think of Interstate 95, the turnpike, the Jersey Turnpike, driving up north to New York City and seeing all those refineries in Jersey. Yeah. That's what I think of when I think of the word industrial.
Well, but, when the Dow was originally calculated, it contained just 12 companies compared to the 30 big names that are listed today. And out of the 12 companies, General Electric was the last one.
Yeah.
Here's a question for you. One of the things about the Dow is that the thing that screws the Dow up, makes it different, I won't say it screws it up, is the Dow is a price-weighted index. So all the other ones are cap-weighted.
Yeah.
So that's why nobody, I mean, I've never put anybody in there is a Dow ETF. I've never used it. If a stock goes up, it used to be over 8, but the multiplier through the years, it's still almost 7. I think it's 6.7. So if a place like Salesforce, which is $230, or United Health goes up $10, it's $70 in the Dow.
Wow.
So in a dollar in United Health counts the same as a dollar in Verizon, which is trading $39. So that's insane. Now your other indices
is there any is there any pressure on the Dow to change that? I mean, because
that's what they are. They've been a price weighted index since the cows come home. So
yeah.
Well, the other one,
so they have no desire to change that at all.
Well, doesn't appear that way. I mean, now the other the cap weighted indexes. God, you got me defining stuff here this morning. See, I can still do it though, Al. You know, it's been a while. A cap weighted index. Let's say your S&P 500, your OEX. OEX is easier. There's 100 stocks, right? Of course, nobody trades anymore. But there's 100 stocks. They say, all right, these are the 100 stocks that are in the OEX. And then they say, okay, Snar Industries, Hal Snar Industries is, you know, he's got 100 million shares outstanding, and the thing's traded, it's traded $100. So that's, what is that, 100 million times? He's got it's a $100 billion company. All right. Now, where does that put him? We do that for all 100 of them. So it turns out that that Hal Industries is now 2% of the OEX. So it's what's called a cap weighted. So if your stock doubles, not only does the OEX go up, you know, 2% times 100. So in other words, you're gonna go up in there. You're gonna go send the OEX up 2% because a 2% stock doubled. But not only that, now you might be 2.7% of the OEX. So there's an adjustment constantly based on every single day of what your percentage index or percentage of the index is. That's what's called a cap weighted index. Yeah. So if your stock, if everything else stays the same and your stock doubles,
yeah,
not only say you were 1% of the index, well, you're going to move the index 1%. Well, it's mathematically, it's more complicated than that. You're going to move the index 1%. But now you're also going to be 2% of the index. So the next day, if you double, you're going to move at 2%. Well, the Dow is not like that. It's all just price weighted.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about it is if an advantage of that is if a stock splits, it
doesn't. Matter. That's why. Now now you got me somewhere where I never understood it because I didn't care enough about the Dow to study it. But now, what happens if a stock in the Dow splits?
Yeah.
That's when you get this. Why does a dollar move not just be a dollar? Why is it now 6.77? Well, that's because of all the stock splits all through the years.
Yep.
And all the adjustments and all the dividends and all the other stuff. So that's what comes into the multiplier. Like when they took a couple of stocks out, it used to be over 8. So if a stock was up a dollar, it was $8.50 in the Dow. And I don't know who they took out and put in where all of a sudden they dropped under 7, but it moves around every time you move a stock in and out. Now, how the hell they do that calculation, that's above my pay grade. You can't ask me that, Al. I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, I got a question for you. Talking about stock splits. When a stock splits in the S&P 500, for example, is there a kind of a surge because people perceive that they can afford buying a stock?
That is a question that is has been around for the ages. And I will mention this to you because I was in grad school. Let's not go into how long ago that was. And the University of Chicago did a study on are stock splits accretive to stock value. Okay, because what everybody knows the stock split, this is what I keep sitting on my little soapbox, Hal, and you, by the way, you're with me on this soapbox. Money is the same thing. What a stock split is, it's really 100% stock dividend. Okay, so if you've got one share of Microsoft, you're now going to own 2. All right, so the math is, if Microsoft's trading right now 450, the math is, I now have 2, but it's the same company. Guess what? The 2 is now worth 225 apiece. Right now, it can go anywhere it wants after that, but the identity is right there. Now the question is, does the split accrete in terms of value? Now, back when I first started the business, a couple things might lead you to believe the answer is yes. Because in those days, people thought that a stock roughly in the 30 to 50 range was the ideal range. Now, the reason why I say that is because if you wanted to do not 100 shares, not a round lot, the term round lot means 100 shares. If you wanted to do less than a round lot, you had to do two things. One is, you had to pay up an eighth. So if the market was 30 to an eighth for the stock, you had to pay 30 and a quarter. And oh, by the way, chances are they charge you a higher commission rate. So people had a real problem in trading. They call those odd lots, round lot versus an odd lot. See, you're getting me into stock history here. Al, did you mean to do that to me today? But so trading an odd lot was more difficult. So the idea was, if you get the thing down to where people could actually trade 100 shares, then you would essentially have more customers. So it'd be easier to trade. Now, whether that means the stock should be higher or not, it definitely was easier to trade. So University of Chicago did this huge study on stock split announcements. And there were people, when I first started the business, that they had huge, well, I wouldn't say huge, they had very successful, whatever you want to call them, there was no internet in those days, companies that did research for people looking for potential stock splits. Now, okay, you might ask yourself, how the hell do you do that? Well, if Snar Industries has 100 million shares approved and 90 million outstanding, well, you can't just double your stock, right? Because you don't have it approved. Because you're going to send everybody another 90 million shares, right? So if Snar Industries at the board meeting last week said, guess what, we're going to authorize another 100 million shares, that's a tag for, why do you need 100 million shares unless you're going to split the stock, right? So people would constantly research that sort of stuff, trying to predict stock splits with the idea that if a stock splits, it generally goes up. Wow. Now, the long part of the story is, the University of Chicago's research came back after years of studying stock splits, came back as an undetermined, Hal. Now, you might ask yourself, why would it be undetermined? Because the question was, rigorously, people used to do questions that were rigorous, does the announcement of a stock split by itself create value? And the answer came back is, we can't identify any corporate actions, or very few, where Hal Snar, chairman of Hal Inc., comes out and says, tomorrow we're going to have a stock split. All the time, it usually is accompanied by another piece of good news. We had good earnings, we're increasing the dividend, and oh, by the way, we have doing a stock split. Nobody would ever narrow it down. It was never a singular announcement. So you could never tell whether the pop in the stock was due to the better-than-expected earnings, the fact that now you're increasing the dividend, or the stock split. So they basically threw their hands up and said, we don't know. How's that?
How many people were looking for them, though? You said people would be out there hunting for this information.
Oh, all the time. Yeah. I knew of three or four, they used to call them, newsletter firms, that when they snuck one, if they found one, they might have 1,000 people paying them $10 a month for this research, and all of a sudden 1,000 people would get a fax saying Hal Inc. would just double their shares, their authorized shares, or triple them or something, and then it might be a 3-for-1 stock split. I mean, they were looking for any kind of clue, any sort of thing in the corporate minutes that you might split your stock, because in their mind it always went up. Because usually it went up because other good stuff was happening, not just the stock split, right?
Yeah. I mean, so what percent of the time when they did a stock split, did they also do the other things that you mentioned?
Like 95. So that's why they said we can't even research it. I mean, virtually nobody ever came out and said, oh, Tuesday morning, by the way, we're splitting the stock, without saying anything else. Nobody ever did that.
Yeah. So, just because of that, I think statistically you can't disentangle those effects. Yeah.
I will say this, that right now, if you want to buy an odd lot, I mean, if you want to buy 10 shares of Apple through PTI, we don't charge anymore. Hmm. So, and you don't have to pay up for it like you used to. Because there were guys that actually, you're digging me into stock history here, but I think people don't know it. There used to be odd lot traders, Hal. So you say, what in the God's name is an odd lot trader? There would be a guy, I guess a guy in those days, or a firm, on the New York Stock Exchange. If somebody, let's pick IBM, because they were there. If somebody wanted to buy 10 shares, 5 shares, whatever, of IBM, I would sell you that 5 shares, 10 shares. I mean, I did this for my nephews when they were born. I'm godfathered all of them. I bought them all like 10 shares at Disney, so they get the annual reports and that kind of thing. And then you get in the dividend reinvestment plan, and every year I contributed to it. So, it worked out fine. But there were guys that if IBM was offered at an eighth and somebody wanted to buy 20 shares, he'd sell it to you at a quarter, he or she. Then there's another 20. And when he got to 100, he'd turn around and buy 100 from the specialist, the round lot at an eighth, and he'd make $125.
Yeah.
Well, it's 100 shares times, you know, whatever, an eighth, $125. So I mean, that's what they did. Now, once in a while, you know, they'd sell you some at a quarter, and the next minute later, it's a half, right? You know, so it didn't always work, but sometimes it went down, too. So that's what they did. That was their scalp. They would sell you the odd lot, the less than 100 share increment, and as soon as you got up to being 100, they'd turn around and buy it from the specialists and try and make the eighth.
An entrepreneur filling a market. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was absolutely somebody filling a hole.
Yeah.
And
the markets are really, really good at that. Well, people will identify these opportunities. They'll jump in, and a lot of them are successful.
But these dividend roll the dice. These dividend reinvestment plans were, I mean, if you like the stock, were really good things. Oh, I didn't. My girlfriend at the time bought the Disney stock. I bought AT&T, which ended up being a total goat bleep. Because the reason why is because when I went into it, I bought the kids each like 10 shares of AT&T. And this is, you know, a long, long time ago. These kids are over 40. And their deal was they would put you into the dividend. They would reinvest at 90% of the stock price. And if you wanted to put money, then you had your little account at AT&T. You know, everybody had one that had one that was in this program. So that if you wanted to, you could send AT&T $500, and they'd buy AT&T stock at the market price, no commission, and they'd add it to your account. So you could have an account with AT&T started with, you know, one share that Grandpa bought you, and between the dividends and every time you get a birthday gift, you send the check in. You know, by the time you're going to school, you could have a real investment there. They were very well run, some of them. But then what happened with AT&T is my brother. They ended up with, you know, I gave them some pretty decent gifts along the way. So they end up with, you know, let's say, I don't know, say 10, 15 grand in there or something along those lines. Well, then the thing splits. So now they've got pieces of seven different stocks, which became a total. How did you remember when they broke up? You got all the individuals. You got Bell South. You got, what was the one in Illinois? You got to remember, Meritech. Then there was Bell, New Jersey. Remember all the little bells?
Yeah, I think there was a Mountain Bell.
Yeah, it was Mountain Bell. I mean, Ameritech ended was Western Electric, right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, all of a sudden, instead of having a small amount of one stock, he's got even smaller amounts of seven stocks. I'm like, what the hell is this? So, yeah, he ended up having to sell them, you know, and I don't know what he put it in. But, anyway, it was kind of a pain. So what do you make of this sudden, I'm going to say, change in valuation of the top 25, I'm not even going to say five because it's more than that, the top 25, 30 stocks in the last 2 weeks. What light went out on somewhere that one stock went up this much and all of a sudden they're all there? I mean, is it a Fed situation? Is it just people pouring in every night because they're investing in the market because it's going up and 401ks are growing? What is it? I mean, it's real strange. I'm not saying it's unjustified. I'm just saying it's unusual that you have a stock like Apple that hasn't come out really with anything of any significance. Well, they've got the AI computer or something they've been talking about. Was it? But even so, the stock's up $300 billion in market cap in 10 trading days. I mean, how do you do that?
Well, I think people are kind of betting that the Fed is going to lower interest rates. I don't think they're going to lower interest rates until we get into the next year, but I think they're betting that the Fed's going to lower interest rates. They feel that the Fed is creating money. M2 is, it never went below. M2 never went below its pre-pandemic trend.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it never did. And using my month over month and my year over year geometric average on M2, if you subtract out population growth, you know, inflation's probably 6-7%. So, you know, the Fed never went below pre-pandemic trend. There's a lot of M2 out there. It's sloshing around. And the people that get access to that newly created cash, what do they do with it? They probably buy, you know, things that you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
So that I think is a lot of it, right? I think that's a lot of it. And I think that's probably most of it, honestly.
Well, every morning in the last few weeks, I mean, this reminds me so much of 87 before the crash. Every day we went up. I mean, it went up virtually. There were people wearing buttons, say no to puts. Guys would sneak in the pit and they'd sell 20 puts in the morning and then just leave for the day and send an order in to buy them back in the close. I mean, this is yesterday, we're down 10 spook points or 10 NASDAQ points when I'm doing the show, and when it starts to go up, 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 there isn't a downtick all day long. I mean, it's not like I've never seen it before, but it's very rare. You'll see the NASDAQ futures up, say, 100. All of a sudden, up 99, up 98, up 97. Struggling to go down even a little bit, and all of a sudden you answer a phone call with a client and it's up 20. Like the minute there's a buyer, everybody just gets out of the way. Nobody wants to sell. Yet if there's a seller, there's all kinds of buyers there. Like, I mean, if it's up 100 and then it drops 5 points, it's a buy the dip. I mean, it's.
I just don't think the Fed is restrictive. I mean, everybody's saying that the Fed is restrictive because interest rates are probably where they should be normally, right? We're at normal interest rates, in my opinion, right?
Yep.
So we're at normal interest rates, right? And the Fed is printing money. There's lending going on. Lending is increasing. Total lending in the United States is increasing. Margin debt, we've talked about this before, is massive. I mean, it used to look massive around the last financial crisis. Now that massive amount of margin debt looks like a molehill next to today's margin debt. So I don't think the Fed ever really stopped. I never really thought the Fed was restrictive, even when it was raising up interest rates.
They tried to get the inflation going forward now down to 2%, which isn't really restrictive. They're essentially getting you back to normal. But they never in a whisper of a word did they say they were going to attack the price bubble that they put in for 4 years.
No.
They're two totally separate subjects, but you never hear them talk about that one. SP Futures up 2. The NASDAQ Futures now up 40. Just keep going. Be right back. Stocks and Jocks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Ricardo on the board. SP futures down one now. NASDAQ futures only up. Well, I've got the June futures are up 15. I think they're toast on Thursday. The September futures are up 16. So we got two of them going on the page here. But retail sales came in at 0.1%, weaker than expected. It's supposed to be 0.2%. So that's casting a little bit of a pall on the market right here. So we're going to keep, since these things are moving all over the place overseas, we're going to keep this kind of short here. We got the Dow futures down 12. No individual stocks have moved that much, and like I say, we're still up here. But let's talk about the bonds. They're actually down. I've got the 10-year rate down 0.25 now to 4.38. So they're down somewhat. Over in Japan, they're up 1.94. So nothing much going on in the bond patch, even with this retail sale number. We've got oil up 4 cents, 80.37. So back over 80. Brent up 1 cent, 84.26. Natural gas up 6 cents, 285. We've got gold down $1.70 only. Now it's right a little bit here. 23.27. Silver down 15 cents, 29.24. Copper down 6 cents, 4.38. And we've got the US dollar not kind of unchanged in this whole mess. 107. British pound 120s, under 127, 126.8. What do you got for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
Sorry, Chief. It's currently 7:34 a.m. right here in beautiful Chicago. We're looking at 76 degrees right now with a high of 89. Breezy and very warm with partial sunshine. An afternoon thunderstorm in a couple of spots. Check on sensitive groups and those without air conditioning. Tonight will be breezy, otherwise very warm with patchy clouds. A little relief from the heat with a low of 75 degrees tonight. Over to Phoenix, we got 75 degrees right now with a high of 104. Plenty of sunshine, and there is an excessive heat watch, so we worry about that. Tonight will be clear with a low of 79 degrees. On the traffic in Chicago, you're looking at 32 minutes inbound Kennedy from Monroe's, 51 minutes inbound Edens from Lane Cook, inbound Eisenhower from Wolf is 35 minutes, inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 19 minutes, and Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan is 32 minutes. Let's go to sports. Onto the MLB. Yesterday, the Giants beat the Cubs 7-6, and we got a few games today in the MLB. The Giants play the Cubs again at 7:05 in Wrigley Field. The White Sox play the Astros at 7:10 in Guaranteed Rate Field, and the Diamondbacks play the Nationals in Washington at 5:45 p.m. Also, the NBA Finals Game 5 was yesterday. The Celtics beat the Mavericks 106-88. That means the Celtics are the NBA champions, taking four of the five games. And also, we got a pretty important game in the NHL today. The Oilers play the Panthers in Florida at 7 p.m. today. That will be the Stanley Cup Final Game 5. That's what they're playing. And that's all I got for you, Chief.
Yeah, these retail sales numbers, a little, you know, it's cut the NASDAQ down here a little bit, but not a whole hell of a lot. I want to talk a little bit with Hal here on some of these numbers and what they sort of mean to people and how, you know, the U.S. is, even though we it looks like we have people riding all the time, by and large, I think we're a country that doesn't really... revolt that much, but maybe we should, maybe we shouldn't. You know, I don't know. I'm not in the Mr. Revolt time, but I'm going to look here. We've seen some, I think, some pretty amazing lifestyle changes. I'm looking here, and I went back to my college reunion a couple weeks ago. I don't know if I'm sure you don't. It's not important. It's not important to anybody here except maybe they remember me talking about it. And, you know, it's in South Bend, right? So I went to Notre Dame. Everybody knows that. And I went around. I had a nice time, saw my friends. And I look at the place, and I look at my group of pals, and I'm going to say today maybe one of us would be here. One guy whose dad was a doctor. This is not our place anymore, Al. This is not. I paid $3,000 my tuition my senior year. Now, if you put that in a CPI indicator, that would be 20 today, and the tuition is probably 60 with another 16,000 room and board on top of that. It's not my place anymore. It's a total lifestyle change for blue collar kid from the South Side. You know, well, my stepfather had a decent corporate job, became a VP of a nice place, so maybe I wasn't as blue collar as I lead on to believe, but those were the roots. And virtually all the other guys that were there in the group were the same way. One guy's dad was an insurance agent, but he had 10 kids, you know. So it wasn't like a couple guys working in the dining hall, that sort of thing. Now, you look at, in today's world, we see this bubble. You and I talk about a price bubble. I mean, most people kind of have some kind of an idea of what we're talking about, and I think certainly feel it. But I'm going to say in the last 5 years, hell, some significant percentage of America is never going to own a new car. Now, when I was that age, car costs, I mean, I used, you know, for God's sake, the car cost, people made at Pullman, they weren't making $20 an hour, they were making 15, so it's 30,000 a year. Maybe 32, something like that, if you work in the factory. A car costs $3,000. Well, now the same guy's making 75 and a car costs 75. I mean, yeah. The changes, these are not just economic numbers, these are lifestyle changes. I mean, I don't know all my buddies, if we didn't go to Notre Dame and all become friends, where would we have gone? Would I have gone to Moraine Valley for 2 years and then, you know, Illinois Circle, which isn't a bad place, don't get me wrong, but how much of this is changing? I'm never going to own a new car. Do I gotta keep buying a junk all the time and watching used car repair prices go to the moon. I mean, Nancy was on yesterday, and how many people now are never going to own a new house? I mean, back in Pullman times, when those people were making $30,000, I'm going to say a house in 1978 was $45,000. So it was what? It was 1.5 times salary. Now what is it? Salary, median salary is probably, well, that's not wasn't median. But even if you're making 100, it's 4 times salary. It's not. Yep. We're not even close. Yep. I mean, how? Why is a group? And I don't want people to start, bullets or water balloons. Why do we put up with this crap?
Well, we have no power. Honestly, I mean, the Fed. I mean, that's what the Fed is doing. The Fed is not a free market capitalist institution. I think capitalism is the word itself has just been under attack. And what capitalism is, in my opinion, it's much different than what people perceive. Capitalism is a market relatively free of government intervention, relatively free, and that includes a central bank. And people are lifted up by these exchanges because they're voluntary. There's nothing coerced, there's nothing forced. But capitalism, as the media defines it, is some corporate raider, tuxedo and tails, with a cane and a cigar, right? Pulling strings, the regulation strings of the federal government, twisting the policy to that person's favor to protect itself from competition. And the Federal Reserve is a central planning body. It's not a free market institution. And what it has done, and all these regulations and rules have done, has created these little monopolies, these little cartels, if you will, that are created by government policy. And the Federal Reserve is, in my opinion, the driver of the difference between those that have and those that don't have. It's the driver. If you look at cash and checking account deposits of the top 1%, the Fed stopped publishing this in August of 2022, but it was shooting to the moon. And the reason why they probably stopped it is because it probably continued to shoot to the moon. The average person in the top 1% had like $400,000 in cash and checking account balances, as opposed to just a few years earlier, they just had a few thousand dollars, back in 2008, 2009. So the Fed is creating this situation. And the Fed has to create this situation because we have politicians that use fiscal stimulus, fiscal deficits. That's their cocaine. And the Fed is their drug dealer. And they're just feeding these politicians and enabling these politicians. So I think that what we have to do to stop this is we have to redefine what the Fed does. The Fed should look at M2 and only M2. I think M2 is the only objective measure here. And it should be saddled with this idea that if the population is growing at 0.5%, M2 should be growing at 5%. I think under that situation, we would restore a little sanity here. And home prices would be closer to a person's annual salary.
Are you sure? Are you sure you're not the product of Milton Friedman having a sneaky trip to Idaho?
Well, I'm a pragmatic, free market, libertarian, Austrian economist. I'm pragmatic.
You are so close to being a classical monetarist. Do you even not know that? You're exactly like those guys.
Well, I'm pragmatic. I would say I'm Austrian, but the Fed is not going away. They're not going to just end the Fed. And so with that reality, we have to change its mandate. It should just be looking at M2, subtract off population growth, and keep M2 growing at population growth. And I think if we do that, we would have an economy for everybody, not just the people at the top end.
Well, I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I'm going to say that after all these years, I can't give you a real good definition of capitalism, because you have to tell me more about the rest of the economy before I can define it. If it's a perfectly competitive agrarian system, then capitalism is what it is. I mean, it's a competitive sort of thing. But once you start talking about stuff that's not competitive, and really, it's not communistic. It's not socialistic, but it becomes almost crony competition, which...
Well, to me, it's state capitalism. It's fascism. That's what
well,
it
is. Well, that's what the same neo, thing that... At,
or neo-mercantilism. It's mercantilism.
Yeah, it's mercantilism, because you can't... Yeah. But, I mean, in terms of the Fed, the money supply stuff, I mean, we have somewhat a unique system here. I mean, I guess some other countries in the world have it, is that you and I, through the banking system, we can create money, which most of the time, if you're on a gold standard, you sort of can't, right? Because when I say that, if it's gold standard and it's the only thing you use, there's only a certain amount of it. But I use the, we talk about an old, if you remember the Virginia City Bank in Bonanza, right? If Ben Cartwright sold timber and dropped, you know, $100,000, well, a lot of money back in those days, into Virginia City Bank, okay, that the government paid him. Now, the government comes out of a bank someplace and into the Virginia City Bank, so that's no change in the money supply. However, if Virginia City Bank, I'm going to go back to reserve requirements, when they had 20% reserve requirements, which we probably still should, by the way, Hal, but we don't. I don't want to get into that. It's another whole issue. But they can now lend out $80,000 to Ricardo.
Yeah.
All right, so Ricardo turns around and puts that $80,000 in the Virginia City Bank. Well, now what? How much money is in the bank? $180,000.
Yep.
Now, when he puts it back in the bank, they can now lend $64,000 to Matt Byrne. And he puts it back in the bank. Well, now we're 100 plus 80 plus 64. So we can increase the money supply ourselves, okay, just by the fact that these are deposits now in the banks, but and they're available. Even though there's loans attached to them, they're cash in the circulation, correct? So
yep.
Now, what the Fed has to do in order to maintain a certain level of money in the system, they have to constantly be adjusting, because if the economy is growing, okay, and people are borrowing and putting money in the bank, and then people are borrowing on that, left to its own devices, the money supply might go up 10% in 6 months. So what the Fed does is they go in there and they sell bonds to people, and they drag money out of the system to maintain the growth rate at wherever they want it. In a perfect world, it would be what you're talking about. It'd be like 2-3% a year, depending, unless
you
have a huge...
They reduce the amount of money available for lending,
And then all of a sudden, if the economy's going down, and all of a sudden Ricardo goes, I'm not building that building, here's your loan money back, okay, and now there's no loan there, and then all of a sudden the bank, we're back to the $100,000 that Ben Cartwright put in originally, we're also capable of decreasing the money supply.
Yeah.
In which case, the Fed has to go out and say, wait a minute, we're going to buy a bond from people, we're going to put more money into the system. In other words, it's a what you mentioned, that's what they ought to do. In a vibrant world, it's a big job for them to do just that. I mean, it's not like it's easy. I mean, you and I would be hard-pressed.
Oh, it's hard to do.
Yeah, it's hard to do.
Really hard to do.
And when the Fed pours money into the system like they did in COVID or any other time, and they said we're lowering the interest rates, but in the backdrop of whatever Mickey DeMope or whatever the Fed chairman happens to be, if some of the people behind you have got to the point where the banks have gotten so powerful that, by the way, certain people, even though we've lowered the rates to zero damn near, Hal and Chief and the listeners of Stocks and Jacks and Ricardo are still paying 25% on their credit card, wait a minute, it didn't flow through to them. So there's an inherent... Yeah. There's an inherent flaw in the system right there. And oh, by the way, if Hal's rich sister gets to borrow 2% and buys a ball team for $2 billion, and by the way, she buys her interest rate for the next 10 years is now 5% under the inflation rate. Guess what? She just made 3% on $5 billion over 10 years, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I mean, go ahead. I just explained a little what you were saying, but now you continue. I mean, because once you start all these screw ups along the way, it's no longer competitive capitalism. It's not socialism. It's something, but I don't know what the definition is. Do you?
Yeah, it's just mercantilism. That's really what it is. I mean, the government. I had this conversation with a lawyer friend. She believes that government regulations are important. And I was pointing out the fact that I guarantee you ExxonMobil, Shell, and other big oil producers, drillers, refiners, I guarantee you they're lobbying for restrictions in their industries. Why? because it keeps competition out. It allows their older wells that would be unprofitable if they didn't lobby, right? So they lobby for the protections, for these environmental protections. In my opinion, these aren't protecting the environment. They're protecting the environment that these companies compete in, right? So they lobby for these restrictions to keep the competitors out, to keep them at bay. So their older wells that they got billions of dollars invested in can remain profitable. And that's how this mercantilism works. And it's not just oil. It's everywhere.
Well, it's in patent laws. Clearly, it's all over the medical industry. I'd say the medical industry is way worse than oil. Yeah. I don't think it's even close.
Let me ask you a question. Tom, you mentioned that during the late 1980s stock market bubble, you said that the traders on the floor were passing around buttons that said what?
Say no to puts.
Say no to puts. Now, to me, everybody wearing those buttons, that's a communication. That's a, to me, it feels like collusion.
Well, nobody, they were buttons.
I know, but still, it's a communication that nobody should sell, right?
Well, what happens when they say no to puts, I traded, talking to the right guy. There were a million people, not a million, there were 350 people in the OEX pit. It was the second biggest exchange in the world, that pit. And everybody had their spot, right? And my spot was right next to the Pershing. The Pershing had eight brokers. That's how many people were in this pit. Pershing had eight brokers, and I stood right next to the guy who did the puts. So I pretty much, on days that went up, I struggled because the public was selling puts, and I made a market, and I never wanted anything to leave my area, right? I had my spot next to my broker. If he had a trade, I traded it, which has a huge advantage in some ways. But it's also a disadvantage because you can get caught up and you see what's happening and you all of a sudden can't react to it because you're trading essentially customer paper, which is what you're there to do. So when the market was doing this every day like it is now, I mean, the first trade out of the gate, the first ticket the guy got was not green. Green's a buy ticket. Yellow's a sell ticket, right? So first ticket was 40 puts, where are you? Oh, God. 2 to 1/8. All right, I'll sell you 20. Next ticket, 40 puts, where are you? 15 a teeny, I'll sell you 20. I mean, no matter what you did, the first 20 trades out of the gate were people selling you puts. And at the end of the day, the market was up. So maybe I was able to hedge these off. Maybe I was able to buy some spoos. Maybe I was able to do something, buy some calls. By and large, everything I got from this broker in the first half hour, 9 times out of 10 was a loser. With that meant say no to puts, because don't let the market, let the public make you buy their crap, basically. Yeah. But then again, there were times, and, you know, I don't sound like a very competitive guy, but, you know, I can be on the softball field, in the pit I certainly was. And all of a sudden we had a big down day. And now the call broker was next to the other guy, and there were all kinds of people that fed off him, right? When I say fed off him, they made markets for him, and he heard them first, okay? Well, all of a sudden, and I could never get any calls because I was always two people away. And once in a while, I'd get some, you know, because it was lunchtime or something, but I could get them from the book or some other place. It wasn't like I was totally shut out of them. So all of a sudden, we have this big down day. And, you know, I knew all these guys were all my friends. We always played golf together. And so they go, hey, what's trading over there? Hey, we want some of those. I go, guys, I don't get any calls. If you want something, let me know. You know, I'm the nicest guy on earth. I'll share, but it's my day, guys. We're going down. If the puts are selling here, I'm buying them first. If you want some, let me know, but you're not going to be first. The other 10 days, I wasn't first. Today, you're not first. Just live with it. And you know what? People said, okay, that's the deal. It's a different world. Yeah. I mean, they weren't going to say, oh, no, you got to share everything on your side, because they knew damn well they didn't share anything on their side. I mean, people, sometimes if you're direct with people, and I say, if you need something, you know, I'll give it to you. Which I always did, you know, which isn't really yours to do, but a lot of times, if it got so busy, if a broker had like 100 lot, this is why, you know, some of the regulations are kind of screwed up, because most of the time people did stuff which were essentially against the rules, or really were not against the spirit of the market. In other words, if if all of a sudden the broker's got, or there's three people want to trade something, and he's got 120 lots, say, you might take the whole 120 so the broker can get on to the next ticket, and then turn around and say, the other two guys, I'll sell you 40 apiece. So you essentially split the ticket up. Now, the customer is better off because he got one price and he got it fast, and now the broker's on to the next ticket. But now if you said that to somebody from, you know, FINRA or somebody who's never been on a trading floor, they go, oh my God, it was a prearranged 40-lot trade to these other two guys. But the fact was, all three people should have been on the first ticket, right? Because the broker didn't have time to write down three names, he wrote down one and the other two guys split them up. Now, nobody got hurt there at all. But now, of course, if you said that to somebody, you know, well, this is 30 years ago, so I guess I'm out of the statute of limitations. But I guess it's a technical rule violation, but it really wasn't any violation at all in terms of executing and giving people the right price and doing all the other stuff. Matter of fact, it helped things, right? But what I'm saying is, so the say no to puts was, with the first 500 tickets into the pit for puts, 400 of them were to sell. The button said, duck when those come by, basically. because you know, I mean, that's what was happening. Everybody in the world, matter of fact, I ran into a lady at a, after the crash, it was all this, you know, all these arbitrations. We didn't know what we were doing, so... I'm actually, believe it or not, I'm giving us, I'm not, the CBOE is giving a seminar, and I think it was Nashville or Memphis or someplace, and I'm sitting there at the booth, and some lady comes by, and she, you know, I won't say, what's the word, kind of frumpy, just a regular lady wandered by from God knows where, and she says to me, you know, I traded some puts in the OEX, and of course, I was very worried about, after the crash, is how much you lost on puts, right? So I go, how did that work out? She goes, well, it didn't. And with the crash, she goes, but you know what? For a year and a half, my broker sold puts in there. I made so much money, I realized this isn't right. You can make this much dough. And you know what? I lost two-thirds of it in one day. You know what? I'm still... I understood that whatever he was doing, I was making too much money, that there was a flip side to this. And guess what? The flip side came. I'll live. off she walked. Yeah. And I'm going, well, there's somebody with some common sense. I wish we could wish we could spread that around.
Well, after the after 9/11, but right before my 9/11, I took some student loan money. And I was on scholarship and I was teaching, so I was making money and I was getting the GI Bill. So I took some of my student loan money and I gave it to my stepsister, Mary Lee, up in Spokane, and I bought $3,000 worth some mutual fund. I forget what it was. And I gave her the money and I said, hey, I got a little extra money here. I want to invest it. When 9/11 hit, about 3 weeks later, that investment was down to $1,600. It was only worth about $1,600. And I called her up and I go, hey, Mary, I just want to call you and find out how you're doing. And she goes, oh, it's brutal. It's brutal. Are you mad at me? And I go, why am I mad at you? She goes, well, your investment's only worth $1,600. And I go, well, in a year, it'll be probably up to $3,000. And it was.
Yeah.
it was actually up to $3,600, I think, a year and a half later.
Well, I got a real quick, one of our first and biggest clients, and yeah, he's got to be long dead. Long, long story. Guy had nothing but dough, Arizona. We became good friends. He claims I was the only liberal he ever let in his house. You know, so you can only imagine what this guy was like. I mean... But his house wasn't really a house. So Audrey and I stayed in the coach house, and I don't know how many thousand square feet that was, with our own private workout facility and a whole bit. So
really, wow!
Oh God, yeah, oh yeah, it was unreal. Yeah. So anyway, we did this seminar. I met him out in Vegas. We're doing a seminar, and the guy says, Walter, what was his name? I'll think of it. He was a big teacher at the Options Institute, Alex Jacobson, and he says, anybody here buy stock the morning after the crash? And when we were way down, and this guy raised his hand, and Alex says, no, you didn't. He goes, well, yeah, I did. No, you didn't. So these guys are having this debate. So finally, Alex goes, what are you talking about? And he goes, that morning, he says, I wasn't invested. He was in real estate and all kinds of other stuff. I wasn't invested in the market, but he had been a broker when he got out of the Army in like 1950 in Columbus, Indiana. So he goes, I show up at my broker. I bring 2 dozen donuts and a bunch of coffees. I'm waiting for these guys on the front steps when they show up. He walked in on the Tuesday after the crash. Nobody even knew where the market was going to go. It was the most eerie feeling. And all of a sudden, next time he ran, I'll tell you about the illegal trades that went on that brought the market back up. So he says, how many thousand shares of 9 different stocks or something, GE and some of the other stuff. He buys them, and he sold them all at the end of the day. He averaged $9 a stock he made.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I'll give you this whole story next week. Remind me, because the person who bought the futures when he didn't have any money that turned the market around the Tuesday after the crash is a interesting story. S&P futures down 3, NASDAQ futures up 5. Again, we were doing a lot better than this until the retail sales numbers came out a little worse than expected. Hal, thank you. Tomorrow, no stocks and jacks. We have Juneteenth day, so the markets are closed. So back on Thursday.
That's all, folks.